what I'd like to do is we're going to move on to the biochemical and metabolic consequences of heavy metals. It's going to be presented to you by Dr. Boyd Haley. Any of you have ever heard Dr. Boyd Haley speak, know you're also in for another treat. He's a terrific speaker. He's extremely well-versed in this area. He has, Dr. Haley has got all kinds of credentials. He's got his degrees in chemistry and physics, and he's basically been doing a lot of research. He's a researcher, he's not a clinician, on the biochemistry of Alzheimer's disease. He's done a lot of work with mercury, and we've had him speak at Dan in terms of the whole implications of mercury and thimerosal in children with autism spectrum disorders. I think you're going to find his talk extremely interesting, and again, give you more information about how these heavy metals that we're exposed to may have biochemical and metabolic effects in the body. I'd like to welcome Dr. Haley.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate the invitation, Ken. I think what you're going to hear a lot today from Ken and what you've just heard from Dr. Patrick is very critical. What has happened recently, and many of you will find it in the newspapers today, is that the Institute of Medicine held a hearing on, you know, the possible causes of autism, the vaccination consideration, et cetera, and came to the conclusion that thimerosal wasn't at all involved and that we should stop doing research in this area. And we should go after more promising areas for the cause of autism, the recent epidemic. However, they refused or did not identify the other hypotheses that they think are more promising. I think this is almost, you know, borders on a criminal activity. I was at that conference. I didn't hear one intelligent question come out of the committee that one would consider cutting and addressing the issue of what could possibly be wrong with giving vaccinations to a child on the day it's born that contains more than a hundredfold excess exposure to mercury, and especially ethyl mercury that bypasses the intestine and everything else, fitting very much in with what you had just heard. We have a major problem. And part of the problem is political. And I would just say ACAM, along with the Academy of Environmental Medicine, along with the International Academy of Oral and Medical Toxicology, of which I'm a member, have totally failed the American people. We have meetings like this, and we talk about good results, things that we've done that have improved the children's behavior by treating them to remove heavy metals, removing heavy metal exposure by removing dental amalgams, by doing chelation therapy or antioxidant therapy. This never makes it out to the public. We never have a press release. When have any of you ever read a press release from the IAOMT, which is ardently against amalgam fillings, you know, countering the statements made by the ADA, whose spokespeople are people who make amalgams? They're not scientists, they're not dentists. What they are, they're people that make a better amalgam filling. So we need to, get in too big a hurry. My typing is... So what I would like, you know, saying today that I think is important is that medical doctors and dentists that really understand toxicity have to become more politically active, because today we are fighting a political battle. You all know that the stuff that you heard, there probably wasn't anything that Dr. Patrick said that really surprised this group of people. Mostly that we know, but if you were to go to the public, you would think things are all copacetic, and everything that we have and everything we're exposed to is wrong, is okay. What I want to tell you, I had a visit from a group from Minnesota, a TV station, WCCO or something like that. They came to me because the ADA told them that this film that you can go to this website, or you can get it from David Kennedy, was false. And they asked me if they could just drop in unexpectedly and visit me and have me demonstrate this, because this is a demonstration I give to my class, in a class I teach to really bright students called Mercury Science and Politics. And so what I did is I got from one of my friend dentists two teeth that had been recently extracted from a child that contained amalgam fillings. And I readily demonstrated to them, and it will be shown on Minneapolis television, that you could make this very easily. We did it in my bathroom in my office with a little UV lamp and a fluorescent screen that you use for thin layer chromatography, which is what my students do. We also had there a mercury vapor sniffer that OSHA, the University of Kentucky's Occupational Health and Safety Office, uses to shut down my labs if somebody breaks a thermometer. And I pointed out to them, I let them do the experiments. It was very easy for them and for this to be shown. And I want to tell you, the one thing that I disagree with Dr. Patrick's speak is that the major contributor to mercury body burden is dental amalgams. Kentucky is a coal-fired power plant state. We have lots of coal. That's our major income from industry. Yet I can go out and test the air in my office or anywhere around the building and I don't get a reading. The minute I take a dental amalgam pulled out of a child and hold it in front of that mercury vapor sniffer, I can see the meter deflect, you know, on the lowest setting about a third of the way. I had the people there take that tooth and brush it 15 strokes with a toothbrush, a standard toothbrush. We placed it back in front of the meter again and it pegged the needle at the lowest setting and went up over tenfold. Very easily. We did the same thing in this type of thing. So anyone that looks at this and we're placing it in our mouths and says that the major exposure we got to worry about, you know, certain other things and ignores dental amalgams is just, whistling Dixie. It's not right. We also have this aspect that the amount of mercury in your blood represents the kind of disease. I want to tell you, measuring mercury or other heavy metals in your blood or in your hair or in your urine is almost worthless. It does tell you, if you find it there, you got a problem. But there are a lot of people that are chronically exposed that retain this material, and they have the lowest blood levels. Now, just at the closing of the last issue, the lady said, Dr. Patrick said that, you know, the report was out that if you had less than 10 micrograms of lead in your blood, you were more likely to be ill, to have problems. Well, of course, if you have 10 kids drinking the same water, the kids that have the lowest level of lead are those that are probably not excreting it effectively. They are the ones that are not making glutathione. And I've looked at your slides, and he's going to tell you all about why that works, so I'm not going to dwell on it. The dummies, and in this I include the Center for Disease Control and the Institute of Medicine and the American Dental Association, who say that mercury and certain other things are not involved, they refuse to even address this type of issue, where in a disease like idiopathic dilated cardiomyopathy, these people have 22,000 times more mercury in their heart tissue than do the normal people. I doubt anybody found 22,000 times more mercury in their blood. There are certain individuals that cannot excrete mercury, and I'm sure that when we get through the whole end of this, some of these people, it's going to be developed in their brain, heart, and other tissues, depending upon that person's particular genetics. But to say that mercury isn't a problem in this country, when we are all paying for these heart transplants of people who suffer from this disease, is idiocy. What you should be irritated about is that this was published in 1999 in the American College of Cardiology journal, and I have talked to numerous cardiologists at the University of Kentucky who are crackerjacks in this area, and they're unaware of it. They don't read the journal. Maybe physicians don't read journals in scientific in their own area. I don't know. But somebody ought to be upset. The American people really ought to have an accountability of why people don't know about these things. This is a work, this was stimulated with Dr. Amy Holmes. She's a physician that has a child that was autistic, and she and I met at several DAN conferences. I don't know if I offended her or not, but she and I got into kind of a little tiff about mercury not being elevated in the hair of autistic children. And therefore, you know, it was very unlikely to be the cause. And what I found out since then, talking to people, is that they don't understand the chemistry and the biochemistry of mercury removal. And I think it fits in with lead, cadmium, and certain other things. You do not remove elemental metals from the blood in the elemental form that they're ingested. They just will not go out. As a matter of fact, mercury in your blood will not stay there more than, I would say, if it's in there 2 minutes. That's a record. It goes into the cells. It has to go into the cells because that's where mercury wants to be. It doesn't want to be in liquid blood. It wants to be in the hydrophobic aspects of the body. That's the reason mercury is neurotoxic. It collects in the hydrophobic regions of the brain, and slowly, if it's methylmercury, is demethylated and becomes very toxic. Mercury has to enter the cells and be coupled enzymatically using glutathione transferase with the molecule glutathione. there is very little glutathione in your blood, less than, I'd say probably around 10 to the minus 6 molar, whereas in your body, it's 10 to the minus 3rd molar. Actually, 10 to the minus 2nd molar, it's 10 millimolar easy. So it has to go in there, and the reason you keep glutathione in the cell at that concentration is to protect yourself from molecules such as mercury and other antioxidants. When it enters the cell, it gets made into the glutathione complex, and there is a receptor inside the cell that uses ATP to bind that glutathione complex and excrete it back out into the blood. That's the reason. If you are an effective excreter, you will have higher blood mercury levels on an exposure than you will have if you are a poor excreter. A poor excreter could be somebody that doesn't make effective glutathione, doesn't have, many processes in biochemistry would affect that if you're low in energy, if you're cadmium toxic. So what we see in this slide here, and this is what the IOM totally ignored, and I would point out, this was repeated by researchers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology who said this is correct. They looked at the zinc mercury level in hair, and it was only elevated in the controls. It was not found at all elevated, no matter how much amalgam the mother had in the in her mouth on the time of birth. And so if we look at this, what we can see is a dramatic difference in a mercury in the hair level of the control people versus the autistic children, and this is plotted against the existing dental amalgams in the mother. Now, if someone were saying that we're eating fish, et cetera, I want to tell you this, our research has shown, the research I did with Amy Holmes and Mark Blaxall, Mark is the one who did a lot of the plotting and the statistics on this. If mercury, elemental mercury, doesn't get in the hair, I'd like to know how it got in the hair of this person. This would indicate if someone wants to maintain that methyl mercury is the only form that shows up in the hair, then mercury going into the mother's body from her dental amalgams gets methylated inside the human. So in a way it can get there. But this is a dramatic difference, and it's been repeated. I think anyone who's tested this has found the same effect. We see that this corresponds to the amalgam count. We look at this and we plot it in an algorithm, you know, with fish consumption, etc., and you get a line like this, and you can see the autistics all pile up at the bottom. Now you tell me, how can an intelligent group of people, medical doctors, at the Institute of Medicine, look at this data and say that this is not consistent with and does not warrant further research? I can stay with that. I don't know that anybody that does one piece of research says we've conclusively proven. But what they recommend is not only does this not happen, but they're saying don't do any research in this area anymore. And that's what I ran into in the Alzheimer's research. Don't look at mercury as being causal. The most neurotoxic metal we know, we put grams in our mouth, and we shouldn't look at this as a cause for Alzheimer's disease or any other neurological disease. If any of you, by the way, want to repeat or learn how to do this mercury vapor thing so you can do it in your own offices, it's not expensive and it's very effective, and you can do it in your bathroom where it's dark. Turn the lights out and it shows up easily. The other point we did is, as you know, the mild and moderate and severe dementia was determined by Dr. Holmes, and Mark Blaxall plotted it with regard to the level of mercury in the hair, and you can see as the level drops, in other words, as these people become poor excretors, or less capable of excreting the mercury, the severity of the disease increases. And I would point out that if you look at the first level, the boys all fall above the line, the girls all fall below. And what this indicates, if you at this time, is that the boys get the disease even though they're better excretors than the girls. And what we found out is that the testosterone levels in have an increased sensitivity to mercury toxicity. And we've done a lot of studies. And if you listen to Dr. Patrick's talk, the thing that should run across your mind is synergistic toxicities. How many of us are only exposed to mercury and aren't exposed to cadmium, aren't exposed to lead or arsenic or aluminum, etc.? We have aluminum in the vaccines. And what this is a study where we take neurons and we culture them for 24 hours. And we add things to this neuron that may kill it. In this case, we're looking at thimerosal, 50 nanomolar thimerosal, will kill most of these neurons, over 60%, around 70% in 24 hours. However, if we go to different points in this time, like here, if we go right here and we look at aluminum kills none of the neurons within 6 hours. 50 nanomolar thimerosal kills about 10%, but if we put the two together, we kill over 60%. The rationale for this is very simple. Aluminum enhances the breakdown of thimerosal to ethyl mercury. It's very widely known to do that. There are probably other aspects to it, but this is what we mean by synergistic toxicity. There's no aluminum by itself is slightly toxic, but if you mix it with thimerosal, that combination is severely toxic. It's also been widely reported in the literature that certain antibiotics, for example, penicillamine, has been used by many people to remove mercury from the body. It is known to bind mercury. A lot of antibiotics, because of their structure, that we call it, they have pi bonds and they'll stack on top of heavy metals, are known to make metals help penetrate into the central nervous system. Rats that are on antibiotics, given mercury, retain that mercury 10 times longer than rats that are not on antibiotics. And how many children do you know of, on the day they get their vaccines, are also on antibiotics for an ear infection or something? If we take neomycin, which is not toxic, mix it with 50 nanomolar of thimerosal, we get an increased killing rate. And if you go out here to the long period of time, you can see that we've dramatically enhanced it. I would tell you tetracycline is even more toxic in conjunction with thimerosal than is neomycin. Ampicillin is the same way. The other thing that we found is if we took this same level of thimerosal and if we added estrogen, we got significant protection against the toxicity. As a matter of fact, we could add enough estrogen to almost totally prevent the mercury toxicity. That's because it probably binds it. However, when we added testosterone at 1 micromolar in a level that was not toxic to these neurons at all, and we put it in there within 3 hours, all the neurons were dead. So testosterone at the same concentration of thimerosal, which is protective, caused rapid killing of the neurons. And I think it's something that does need more investigation, but I can tell you, when you have people like the Institute of Medicine saying, don't do research in this area, let's go to more promising areas, and what they mean really are more promising areas that will keep the vaccine manufacturers from being held culpable for what they've done to our children. That's what they're talking about. If we talk about the contrast, does this make sense? You know, we know this is a fact now. I mean, there's been 3 or 4 people, different groups repeat this. Jeff Bradstreet has reported autistic children carry a higher mercury body burden when doing a mercury challenge test. So it's not like they don't have mercury in their body or they're getting rid of it in utero. They're collecting it, retaining it, and they're the ones that are suffering. And what we can explain this is micromercurism, genetic susceptibility to retention toxicity. And there's an obvious gender difference, and I think this is explained by the testosterone effect. Now, you know, I hate to call people stupid, but I think really I should jump on stupid this time. There is articles in the literature where they're finding excess testosterone in the amniotic fluid of mothers who give birth to autistic children. And then they extrapolate this to say, well, it is this that's causing this autism. It's somehow making these children have more male-like brains, and males are more autistic than females. And, you know, before 1985, there were mothers that had testosterone in their amniotic fluid. Why didn't we have an autism epidemic a long time ago? I mean, you can't blame it on something. There, when you have an epidemic, there has to be some exposure or something happened at that point in time that set this off. And I think to ignore vaccines and the mercury delivered by vaccines to children on the day they're born and in their first year of life, to ignore that, I would say the Institute of Medicine made themselves look stupid. I mean, and you can quote me on that. That was a stupid analysis and a stupid press conference that Dr. McCormick put out yesterday. And it means that you guys shouldn't even exist. What you're working on today, heavy metals, can't be impossible. And the other thing is, we had, into the Institute of Medicine hearing, Geyer and Geyer present data showing from the Vaccine Adverse Effect Reporting System showing that there was a high correlation, risk factors up to over 20 with regard to vaccinations. Of course, the CDC and their Simpson Wood meeting and their manipulated thing said, oh, this didn't exist. And they spend lots of money trying to fight this. And, you know, I don't know who's right for sure, except I think, I can tell you, Mark Geyer totally disagreed with me about the thimerosal. You and I, Dr. Cave and I, were sitting at the meeting where he blew me out of the water by saying, hey, I've done the epidemiology and I agree with the previous speaker, where before he'd come right up my face and tell me that little bit of mercury couldn't cause the damage and that I was damaging the vaccine program. He was not on my side until he did his epidemiology. Anyway, the epidemiology is here and is very effective. However, they chose not to believe Dr. Geyer, but to believe certain other people. And, you know, I would point out also, they said many years ago, that there wasn't an epidemic, and yet if we look at the rate of increase of people getting treated under the Individuals with Severity Act, Disabilities Act, we can see that that's quite a bit, and I think a lot of you have seen it. Now, at the Institute of Medicine, I got after a Dr. Hivid from Denmark, who presented data saying thimerosal was not involved in autism. And when I tried questioning him, Dr. McCormick shut me up because I asked him, what's the rate of autism in Denmark versus the United States? He could not answer. You can go and see the film. The video is available. If you look at it, and Dr. McCormick told me to quit badgering the speaker, comes forward and tells me, because that was critical. If you look at the rate of autism, here it is in 2000. You can look over here, persons. You know, 5 is the highest number they have on this schedule here. In the United States, it's 60. Across the channel in England, it's somewhere between 40 and 60. So you go and you look at their data, and this is the epidemiology they want to believe. They said that the rate of autism from 1970 to about 1990 in Denmark was less than 0.5 per 10,000. They removed the thimerosal about this time. You can read here, thimerosal removed from the vaccine, and lo and behold, the rates go up. Now, how can you? What kind of logic do you have in that? You remove an exposure to a neurotoxin on the day you're born, and the rate goes up. I mean, that's idiotic. It doesn't make sense. What happens, you have to look at some of the other. They added the outpatients in 1905. They added a large Copenhagen clinic in 1992. They changed the autism classification in 1994. And so you start getting better data. At this time in the United States, the rate was up to here. So what they did is they started keeping better records, doing it right, and they got the same rate that the United States had back in 1970, 1980. Now, why didn't they go up to 60? In Denmark, they don't vaccinate children on the day they're born. They wait 5 weeks minimum. This is from Dr. Hibb. They give half the dose that we give. And they do that after 5 weeks. At that time, we're giving our children the second full dose. So while we've given them something like 24 micrograms of mercury, starting on day one, they are giving them 6 micrograms in 5 weeks. Right there, why isn't somebody making hay of that? Here is a country that does not aggressively vaccinate with as much mercury or as at early a date as we in the United States or people in England do, and they don't have the dramatic increase in autism that we have experienced. We don't look at the big picture. Instead of this, they use this data, which would make you want to upchuck, to be honest, if you're a scientist, and say, this proves that thimerosal is not causal. In my opinion, there's a big movement in organized medicine that's controlled by the pharmaceutical industry that will do anything and say anything that they have to prevent them from being held culpable for this. The most important conclusion that we can come to now, and if you just listen to the prior speaker, go back to what she said, and some of the things that we're going to talk about, you're going to say that there's a group that can effectively excrete mercury and they're at greater risk of exposure than other general population. These may be APOE4 carriers or people that are methionine deficient or deficient in glutathione production, etc. But these people do exist, and this also holds for Alzheimer's disease. And I would tell you, there's a group here from New Zealand. They're giving a talk on the APOE ratios found in autistic children. And I would suggest you go to their talk. They will advertise it. Maybe they can make a comment at the end. And they're finding increased APOE4 carriers in autism. We'll talk about that. We can now go back and say, does any of this make sense biochemically? And what I'm trying to get across to you, because I can teach biochemical mechanisms, you know, and I love doing that, but I think it's important. Nelson and Bauman put out a paper saying thimerosal couldn't be found, and one of the things they pointed to was a Shields study of around 700 children. They make the comment, boys with higher levels of hair mercury perform better on some tests, including the Boston naming test, etc. Well, what does that tell you? These kids were all eating fish. They were the ones that were effectively excreting the mercury, the ones healthy enough to do it. Those that weren't effective at excreting it were the ones that were getting sick. And the American Dental Association, I was well aware of this, has used this as an aspect of saying, well, you see, a little bit of mercury is good for you. Mercury may have a biological positive effect on people at low levels. And how people could look at this data and not get a little bit excited, you know, constantly amazes me. This is another paper published in the Journal of the American Dental Association. They were looking at the level of mercury. This was the first paper Eamon and Marksberry did with a dentist called Sachs, who was responsible for doing the dental amalgam removal or evaluation. But what I want to point out to you, these were nuns, most of them, that had died. And they had controls and people who were dead. If we look at the levels, in a histogram, 6 of 110 subjects died with mercury brain levels above 200 nanograms per gram wet weight. 200 nanograms per gram wet weight is 1 micromolar. That is a lethal exposure to mercury, to any cells in culture that you would do. That's 1,000 times higher than is necessary to kill a neuron. And this minimally represents these levels And these are highly toxic levels. Anyone would say that. At 100 nanograms, if you drop the level down to half micromolar, this increases to about 15% of the subjects who died with high toxic levels of mercury in their brain. Now, how did it get there? And where did it come from? I mean, to say that mercury is not being collected in the human body at toxic levels with this data, whether you want to believe it correlates with Alzheimer's or not, is the option that any reasonable person could probably differ on someone. But you can't say that having this level of mercury collecting in our brains of our elderly is a good idea. Tell me that that wouldn't exacerbate the progression of Parkinson's, ALS, MS, Alzheimer's, or just general dementia. I mean, this is a form of lunacy to say that mercury from amalgams are not involved. In that last study, they decided there was no correlation between amalgams and Alzheimer's disease. However, these earlier workers, before they got into an interaction with a dental-funded project, found HD levels in AD brain to be quite high. They found the largest differences were for bromine and mercury, both at the P.05 level. They then decided, well, we'll be clever. Since the mercury is elevated in the brain, we can measure your nails, and we can tell you whether or not you're being made toxic to mercury and therefore demented. But they found mercury was decreased in the nails of AD subjects compared to controls. And they blamed it on the environment, that the AD patients aren't out in the garden. But I think anybody 85 years old is probably not in the garden very much. The mercury tended to decrease in the nail with increasing age of patient and with the duration and severity of the dementia. What I'm trying to point out is that when you look at nails and hair, they're about in the same category of tissues that are being made with the keratin and everything. As these people lose their ability to excrete the mercury, the level in their nails decreases, and these are the ones that are becoming more demented as they age because they're losing the ability to excrete the mercury that's coming into their body from the various sources. This decrease was counter to the elevated mercury observed in the AD brain as compared to age-matched controls. So, you know, you don't have to be an Einstein to look at this data. This was not done with any vested interest. This was done before I ever moved to the University of Kentucky. This data was trashed, more or less, totally ignored. And what they said is controls have less mercury in their brain and more in their fingernails, whereas ADs have more in their brain and less in their fingernails, and this ratio increases as the disease progresses. It's just saying we're unable to get rid of heavy metal toxicity as we age. That would make sense with everything that I've ever read about the aging body and its ability to detoxify mercury. I would say perhaps these subjects could not excrete mercury as effectively as normal subjects, and that's the major risk we have as we age. The ADA takes advantage of the fact that when we're young, healthy, up to middle age, that we can excrete mercury, and look how healthy we are with a mouthful of amalgams. But when we reach elder, the old age, when some of our amalgams have been pulled out because our teeth have gotten bad and we don't have a high level, that's when we become sick. But the sickness starts and the buildup of mercury starts at the early ages when we're still carrying a mouthful of amalgam. So I would say, you know, the plausibility of mercury as being causal for Alzheimer's disease is quite real. Most of you can read that as well as I can. But in Alzheimer's disease, it doesn't make any difference where you live in the first world. The ratio rate of Alzheimer's disease is the same. You can live in the city, the country, and you have to have a toxicant. They did a study after World War II on 500 sets of identical twins showing that it was not genetically inherited. You inherit the susceptibility, but you do not inherit the disease. There has to be some external exposure. You do not spontaneously start developing Alzheimer's disease or make amyloid protein. I would point out that if you look at the amyloid hypothesis, there's a lot of articles written in the paper today about the amyloid cabal that prevents any other form of research being considered as being causal. And the item came to the head when they took rats that were the Alzheimer's model. These rats made amyloid protein and became demented. Some researchers, a couple of young Chinese researchers, did a knockout gene so that you could not process the amyloid protein, so the rats did not make the beta amyloid plaques that are identified with Alzheimer's disease. The rats became demented anyway. And what this is saying is what I've been saying for about 15 years. The amyloid protein is a result of the disease. It's not the cause. The cause has to be something that's coming from the outside, a toxicant or an infectious vector. And yet, we'll follow that and say what's going on. Now, I'm going to go through a few things to show you some of the information that tied this into it and how I got into this mess. Microtubulin is a protein. that goes from the inside of the cytosol of a nerve cell and runs all the way out to the end of the axon. It is the major protein in all brain. It is by far the most prominent protein along with actin. When we look at this, this is what transports organelle vesicles. Usually this vesicle, the major one, carries glutamate, which is an excitotoxic amino acid and a neurotransmitter, from inside the cytoplasm of the cell to the synaptic cleft. This structure here is very sensitive to mercury, and mercury does not have to get inside the cell body to hit this. It can hit it out here at any region where it can diffuse into the cells. When we look at this and we do a plot of the effect, the viability of this, which we measure by our photoaffinity labeling method, in all of the human controls, the tubulin is very active. However, when we get into people who are proposed to have AD, we see that a lot of them have no tubulin viability left. Most of them have lost a good portion of it. And the ones you see here who look almost like normals are people who had diffuse Lewy body disease.